First Palm Media. You are listening to Mushing on First Palm Media. Visit our website at mushing.com.
Hello and welcome everybody to Mushing. This is Robert, and tonight I am joined by a guest calling in from Duluth, Minnesota. His name is Tony Coughlin. He is the owner of Endurance Kennels. They do a whole bunch of stuff up there. Tony, how's it going today?
It's going good. I wish we had some more snow.
Yeah, it has been a crazy year for you guys down there. Lots of races have been canceled. And interestingly enough, we had, I think, record-breaking snow up here in Alaska. But as I said, it's pouring down rain and melting very fast. A very crazy winter. I think climate change is upon us. What do you think?
Yeah, it's just so hard to say, because last year we had, you know, record snow, and we were dealing with tons of snow. And this year, I think we've got a total of 17 inches so far. It's just, I've never seen anything like it.
Wow. Yeah. For those of us that are involved with winter sports, I'm sure all of us are biting our nails for sure, which takes us to our first segment. You've been involved with the sport for a long time, about 30 years or so, Tony. Can you give us a quick bio and tell us who you are and what you're all about, please?
Yeah, I started ski touring, you know, back in 1994 with my grandpa's hunting dog. I was, you know, a cross-country skier back in high school, and then I did got away from that and just started helping out with some of the mushers at the local races here. And I was going to college and couldn't have sled dogs of my own, but got to play with them at the races, and then started getting my own sled dogs after I was done bike racing back in 2009. So that's kind of where the switch happened. In 2009, we started doing some dry land and some smaller 6 and 4 dog, you know, sprint events.
How big of a dry land circuit do they have in Minnesota? I know it's very big in southern Wisconsin, Michigan, Illinois, Ohio, etc. What's it look like up where you live?
In Minnesota, you know, we didn't have a lot of dry land back then. I think we just had the East meets West, which was in St. Cloud. We had that for a couple years, but most of the dry land stuff was done by the Wisconsin Trailblazers. And then over into Michigan, you know, we haven't done dry lands, I don't think, since 2014 was the last time we did some dry land racing. But the Wisconsin scene is going pretty strong.
It is. And I ask that because with this crazy weather that we're having, you might have to do a abrupt switch going from dog mushing to bike touring or carts or something like that.
If we can stay out of mud, that would be great. I think I've seen some advertising for some spring dryland races already. So, you know, got to get out there and prove your dogs a little bit.
Right. And that's sort of how we are in Alaska, very similar to Minnesota. We didn't have a big dryland scene up here until the last few years. And we sort of did it by chance because of the weather, you know, with those later winters coming, and you never know how much snow is going to be around. A heck of a lot of sprint mushers go into dry land. I think it's kind of a natural progression. And I know that you are primarily a sprint dog driver. Is that safe to say?
Yeah, we do sprint. I spent so many hours, you know, training as a bike racer that had no desire to do the overnights, and I'm not very good. You know, as soon as it gets dark out, I get pretty tired. I'm more of an early morning person, and, you know, handling for the middle distance and distance races that we had down here, you know, staying up all night and going through the night and driving the dog truck, and that just didn't appeal to me whatsoever. And then, you know, I found out about the sprint racing, and that just seemed so much more appealing.
And I'm with you there. As I get older, I think you and I started mushing around the same time. Boy, it sure is nice to be able to sleep in your own bed at night, or a hotel, I guess.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
So let's talk a little bit about your bike racing career before we jump into your dog racing. You had talked about on your bio that you did, I think it's called cyclocross. Is that right?
Yeah, I did every facet of USA Cycling except for downhill mountain bike and BMX. So, you know, cross country mountain bike, road cycling was my primary sport, and then track. I raced on the track, raced cyclocross and cross country mountain bike. But yeah, so, you know, I started that in college, and I wish I would have started a lot earlier, but, you know, bike stuff is so darn expensive. But, you know, went through the ranks of USA Cycling up to top amateur level and started racing with the professionals in the Midwest. We raced all over the U.S., all the way out to Washington, all the way out to New York, and then up into Canada and down in Central America. So I spent a lot of time doing that all the way until 2008 or 2009. I think I was pretty much done with that.
And what is cyclocross? I'm sure a lot of listeners may have not heard that before.
Cyclocross is pretty awesome. It's a fall sport, and it goes into early December. But you're on like a it's a cross between a mountain bike and a road bike. Has the larger wheels like a road bike. You're off course, usually on like a golf course or whatever. And then they have obstacles. They have hurdles that you need to either bunny hop with your bike or quick dismount, run over it. And you just do loops and loops for however many hours that the category that you're racing in. It's a ton of fun.
I have seen the bikes, and they are a little bit of that hybrid, like you said. I think that would be a really fun event. And that sort of is a progression into bike touring with your dog, maybe not with obstacles, but a very similar bike setup, except you just have a dog or two out front.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I was, you know, when I first started, I was so fit and could ride so fast that, you know, even my fastest dogs could, you know, I could ride faster than they could run. So we were hitting some very high speeds, like just under 30 miles per hour. And you know, we won pretty much every race here in the Midwest, you know,
wow,
that we had with dryland back then. But, you know, as you get older and you're not training as much and, you know, that's, you get slower too, and the dogs have to do a little more work. But yeah, we were cruising pretty fast back in the day. That was a lot of fun.
Wow, that's really cruising at close to 30 miles an hour. My goodness. So let's talk about your dogs, Tony. You are very active on social media. I think I follow you just about everywhere, and you're always taking really good pictures of your dogs and sort of the day in the life at your kennel up there. Tell us a little bit about them. Where do they come from? What lines? That sort of thing.
Yeah, so we have all sprint lines. I kind of started with some of the Egil Ellis and Eddie Streeper lines. We have some, Earhart lines way back in there. I think there's even some purebred German Shorthairs from Germany way back in there. And of course, Arlie Reynolds lines. Now we got some Buddy and Terry Streeper blood and some Ray Cook blood from Jake Robinson and Bemidji. But yeah, they're all sprinters. It's going to take, you know, a good four generations on both sides to kind of make our own dogs. But we try to have one litter of puppies per year. You know, they're limited dogs. You know, there's some dogs that can get into the open class distances, but, you know, usually the 10 to 14 miles where they do better with our kennel.
And how many dogs do you have right now?
Right now we have 47 in the kennel.
47. And I'm looking at your website right now, and you got a heck of a lot going on. But one thing in particular that you do is rides for families or tours, if you will. That's somewhat uncommon to do that with these houndier sprint type dogs. How do they fare with these shorter runs with heavy weight in the sled and that sort of thing?
Well, I didn't know if I wanted to do that. You know, when I first moved up here, I was still just racing and I didn't know if I needed different dogs for that or if I could give it a try. And then I started doing a couple rides. I had a toboggan sled and it was a lot of fun. We started meeting people from, you know, around the U.S. and then we started meeting people from around the world and, you know, getting on TV and it just went crazy. So there was a demand for it. But yeah, that's a good question. You know, so we train, we train up to 14 miles an hour in the fall with the ATV and get a little more speed once we get on the sled. And we can hit, they can hit, you know, 18, 19. I don't let them run any faster than that on the downhills out here. But, you know, we just kind of size people up when they get here, how much weight we have in the sled, how many dogs we need. But with our typical loop that we do, we only need 8 dogs if you got 8 big boys in there, you know.
Right. And what is a day in the life of a tour look like? Are they driving their own sleds? Are they just going for a ride or what?
We used to let people, we used to have a drive your own. We stopped doing that one because people weren't really expecting the jolt as soon as they pulled the quick release.
Yep.
You know, we gave them the training and, you know, the know-how, and we'd always go out in front of them because I'd say at least 50% of the people would fall off. And then we stopped doing that ride just because people were, you know, falling off too often, and they were spooking the dogs and they were breaking the sleds, and just it just became a liability. So we replaced it with a tandem ride. So I have a tandem sled where I can put one passenger in the front, I stand in the middle, control the team, and then we have a passenger on the back that is standing and can see what is going on, and then we stop and switch halfway. So that kind of replaced it. And then we have, you know, big toboggan sleds, and kind of found out the hard way what our limit of weight in the sled is, you know, because I can't steer the sled when there's 1,000 pounds in there plus me on it, because the runners dig into the snow so much the sled just goes right into the woods. So we found our our limit for adults that we could put in the sleds. But the shorter rides are great for the little kids because they're not out in the woods for 4 or 5 hours. And even with the shorter rides that we have, you know, those little kids, as soon as their toes and hands get cold, they start crying, and they don't want to be out there all day. So it's really good for families. It's good for people that just want to get a taste of it. And if they want to go longer, I got, you know, places that send them that they want to go half day or full day.
Yeah. And that is a sort of a typical tour setup. Where are a lot of your clients coming from? Do you have something like on TripAdvisor or something like that, or is it word of mouth or what?
I do a lot of advertising on Google, you know, our website's always up there in the top area in Minnesota. I would say those are the two. Our primary market is the Minneapolis-St. Paul area, people that come up here. We don't get a lot of locals. We'll maybe get a handful a year of locals because they think they have to go to Ely or Grand Marais to go dog sledding, but they can come right here in their backyard.
Yeah, and be home before dinner. They don't have to do a overnight and everything else.
Yeah, they can have a full day. They can go have lunch and go snowshoeing or, you know, do whatever.
So, Tony, I know that you're very active with helping out with a bunch of other races as well, and I'm interested to talk to you a little bit about that. I don't think we've had a race sort of behind the scenes race organizer on for a while. I know you've worked with several in your term. What is or has been your role with some of these races? Because you have a heck of a lot of experience.
Are you talking about sled dog races specifically or other events that I've put on?
Other, that would be very interesting to talk about, because there, I'm sure there's a lot of compare and contrast with, say, I don't know, like a marathon compared to like the Bear Grease or something like that.
Yeah. So I started in college. We're in rec sports there working, back in 1998, I think was the first race I put on. We had just our 5K on campus, and started working with it, you know, my mentor Rod Raymond there at the university, and started helping, you know, put on his triathlon and just doing little stuff behind the scenes, not taking the wheel or anything like that. And then you know, I was a swim coach USA for USA Cycling. I started putting on some bike races with our club, and I had a 4-day stage race here. Brought back the Duluth Classic in Duluth. I think that would have been like 2007, 2008-ish. And then I had a break from putting on events, and then got hired as the race director for the North Shore Inline Marathon, which is the largest inline marathon in North America and second largest in the world. And I was there as a race director for, I think I put on 6 marathons. And then left that job to do full-time mushing. And then now I'm back on the board of directors for the Inline Marathon as the vice chair.
So what do you think the biggest challenges are with a people-only race, like a marathon or something like that? And then when you add in dogs and checkpoints and, you know, all of those other logistics, I'm sure that there are pros and cons for both styles of race organizing. Is that right?
So I was the interim president of the Bear Grease in 2014. And then I put on our own sprint race up at Spirit Mountain for a few years. So I did have some experience working in, you know, the sled dog stuff. With the Bear Grease, I was more focused on just the whole picture and then the marketing, because we were really struggling to get the previous organization was really struggling to get prize money for the mushers. And that's kind of why they turned the hands over. But so that's a good question, because when you have the larger events, you're dealing mostly with participants and customer service. And then you have the logistics of dealing with the multiple governments. You know, we had with the inline, we have to deal with 2 counties. You got to deal with the state patrol. You got to deal with the city of Duluth, and you got to deal with, you know, the deck, the property owners. And then, you know, the busing and then t-shirts, bib numbers, timing, like all that stuff has a lot of common denominators. But what's nice about a dog race is that it's a little more isolated. It's a little more contained. And you do have a lot of road crossings, which you need, you know, your key volunteers and stuff like that for. You need to have good timing. You need to have, you know, good quality, dedicated volunteers that are willing to stay up, you know, for hours and hours and hours just to make that race happen. So it's a whole different ball game where, you know, at the end of the day, we're putting on, you know, the 10K, you can go home and sleep in your own bed and shut it all down, you know?
Right. And you know, I wanted to ask you this because so many people have no idea of what it takes to do something like that, whether it is that 5K or a 300-mile sled dog race. There are hours and hours of work that are behind the scenes with a lot of time it's volunteers, right?
Yeah, it's so much volunteer work. It's pretty rare a race director, unless you're involved in a big organization like I was with the Inline Marathon, that you're going to get paid. And, you know, even the pay wasn't that great for as many hours that you put in. But, and I always said too, you know, you shouldn't race your own race, because there's always something to do. There's always something to take care of and communicate. And it's pretty tough to race your own race, but it you know, it's nice in a, with dog mushing, is that you can have that closed course, or that course where you're not running not down the highway, or, you know, down the freeway, or where you need, you know, police and
crossing guards and all that. Yeah. I think that's a huge takeaway, Tony, when you say it's very difficult to race your own race. And, you know, involved with clubs up here in Alaska, we are on such a limited personnel because we have so few volunteers and so few club members, that if we want to make the race successful, obviously it's tough for us to want to run our own race with our own dogs and then still be there to do the timing and the race marshal and all of that. It is a tough job to be able to do both, isn't it?
Yeah, you really got to thank the volunteers. You know, as a musher, I always thank the, you know, people that work in the road crossings and the organization, and thank them in person. You know, the emails and social media, that doesn't mean anything. But if you're there, you know, in person, just really shake their hand, look them in the eye, and thank them, you know?
Right. So let's switch gears a little bit, Tony, and jump back into talking about your dogs. Of course, this is Mushing Radio, and we talk a lot about dogs here. I always like to ask my guests to tell a story or two about one of your favorites or one of your standouts. Can you do that? Who is one of those special dogs in your kennel?
Gosh, there's so many good dogs we've had, and they've all, they all have their own personality, and they all have their own strengths and weaknesses. But I mean, I guess my old lady Yana, she's still going right now. She's going to be 15 in April, and I remember when she was young, I picked her up. She was 9 months old or 8 months old. I think she was 8 months old. And she got car sick on the way home. And, we gave her a bath and kept her in the house for the night, and then got her out into the kennel the next day. And she just cried and cried and cried, wouldn't stop crying. And then I went down and got her brother like a couple of days later. And once I got him up there, those two were companions in the kennel. But anyways, she started running in lead at 11 months old. And when we were harness breaking those dogs, me and my roommate were just running out the back and running across a pond. And he would run on foot in the snow in front of us to get him to run. And it took a good 2 weeks to harness break those dogs. It was very challenging, very difficult. And after that, the next year, she started running in lead all the time with my other strong Jihad leader, and many pictures of her running all the sprint races in Wisconsin and all the dry land races. And she raced in lead until she was 7 years old. So, and then she helps train the young dogs now. And at 15, she's almost 15. She's still in harness, not as fast as she used to be, but she just loves to run. And she's such a great dog. She lives in the house. She's lived in the house for quite a while, and she goes on camping trips and just proud to be around. She's really fun.
And what was her name again, Tony?
Her name is Yana.
Yana, very good. Yeah, those older dogs, man, they do hold that spot. I have a older dog named Bodie. He's 14 right now, and very similar situation that you have. So thank you very much for sharing. There are so many stories that we could talk about. We could probably be here all day to talk about every dog in your kennel and have a story about each one of them. So the next thing I ask, Tony, is the questions I ask all of my guests. Are you ready for them?
Sure.
So the first question is, where do you see the sport of dog mushing in any capacity, whether it be dry land or Iditarod or whatever? Where do you see it in the next 5 to 10 years?
I think it's fairly the same as it is now. I was involved with the IFSS as a board member on the United States Federation, and the European circuit is really strong, but I think it's going to be harder for mushers to travel. So I'm hoping that we see more participation in our regions, and then try to encourage mushers to travel. But I don't see much change. I don't hear too many. There, a handful of years we've heard mushers getting out of it, but I haven't heard of too many that are really getting out of it in the last couple years.
Yeah, I agree with you. And I think, of course, weather could have a big issue with that, going one way or the other. But, we talk to mushers on every side, whether it be long distance or sprint. And I know that the dry land scene is big time all over the world, here in Europe and Alaska here and down south and everywhere. I think that's going to really continue to grow. And as long as we have up-and-coming people in the distance world, I know juniors up here in Alaska are just doing it. They're doing awesome up here. I think that the sport has a lot of potential in the next decade or so.
Yeah, it really does. That dryland, it's a good intro. A lot of people are good at biking, but they might not be so good at skiing, or, might not want to get, 10 to 15 dogs, but all they need is, they have the one and two dog category in a lot of these sled events. So there's a little bit of something for everybody, especially at the sprint races.
Yeah, and you don't have to have one of those fancy $5,000 road bikes like you're used to riding in those big time events that you used to do back in the day. You could literally do it with a few $100 mountain bike and you'd be set. Do you agree?
Oh, totally. Yeah. Anything that's got two wheels and a chain and a couple pedals.
If you don't mind, if I can keep you for just a second longer, that brought up a new question. Since you were so involved with bike racing on so many different levels, do you have any advice for somebody that's just getting started with that same statement that we talked about? You don't need something really fancy, but if somebody is just getting involved, Tony, what would you tell them if they're thinking about going to the bike store or looking online or whatever? What advice could you give those guys?
Man, that's a good question. You know, it's been so long since I've you know, had to think about that. But yeah, even if you just have to borrow somebody's bike or borrow a scooter and see if you're going to do it, but try to get with somebody that knows what they're doing, because you're going to save yourself a lot of time. And it's not just the bike; it's training the dog and getting the dog to move forward, getting the dog to chase somebody that they know, you know, keep it short, keep it fun for you and the dog, and then just progress from there.
Great advice for sure. So last question for you before we get socials and all that, what's up for you in the future? What are you thinking about?
Well, I wish we had some snow. Well, we're looking forward to, puppies. Some of the girls are coming into heat right now, and of course it's never the ones that you want to breed, but yeah, so we're looking forward to possibly having some puppies this summer. Looking forward to free running the young dogs again this summer, and then building a dog box, new dog box for the truck. Trying to take a look at some trailer options so that we can get to the races next year. We wanted to race this year, but all the races down here were just canceled.
Yeah.
And got some really nice young 2 and 3 year old dogs that are just jamming, and a handful of leaders out of that one litter too. And it would be a bummer not to race them, because I haven't had fast young leaders in quite a while.
Well, I hope things work out for you weather-wise. I know that we're recording this towards the end of February, so we have a month or two left of winter, so maybe you guys will get a dumping before the end of it. Who knows? There might be a race that pops up late season, huh?
I sure hope so. You know, there's always a race up north in March, and all we need, yeah, is one solid dump of snow and a little bit of cold weather, and that'll get us into it, you know. 2014, we had 55 inches of snow in April. We were mushing on snow until the middle of May. So anything's possible.
Anything is possible. So Tony, I am looking at your website right now, endurancekennels.com. Very well done website for sure. People can check it out there. Where are you most active on social media? Is it Facebook, Twitter, Instagram? Where?
Yeah. So I kind of just float across all of them. We try to do videos for TikTok, and then transfer those over onto Facebook. Instagram likes to be more photos, but we'll put photos on Facebook too, and then YouTube, but we don't do much on Twitter. We have an account, but yeah, I would say TikTok and Facebook.
Well, we will definitely share your links over on your show notes page. And with that, we are just about out of time. Tony Coughlin, the owner of Endurance Kennels, endurancekennels.com, is our guest today. Tony, it is a pleasure. I'm glad we're able to connect, and we'll talk again soon, okay?
Yeah, thanks a lot, Robert. Appreciate it.
Thank you. On behalf of my guest today, this is Robert for Mushing. We will see you guys next time. Goodbye.
Are you a fan of the great outdoors? Do you enjoy the thrill of speed and adventure? Then listen up. Introducing Mushing, your ultimate guide to the exciting world of dog-powered sports and mushing. Whether you're a seasoned musher or just starting out, Mushing has got you covered. Get ready to immerse yourself in captivating stories of incredible sled dog races, expert training tips from seasoned professionals, and gear reviews to help you make the right choices for your team. From the breathtaking landscapes of Alaska to the snowy trails of Scandinavia, Mushing takes you on a thrilling journey through the world of dog-powered sports. Don't miss out on the latest issue, packed with exclusive interviews with top mushers, in-depth articles on sled dog nutrition, and stunning photography that will transport you to the heart of the action. So whether you're dreaming of competing in the Iditarod or simply want to learn more about this incredible sport, Mushing is your go-to resource. Subscribe now and get ready to unleash your passion for mushing. Visit our website at mushing.com or find us on your favorite podcast platform. Mushing, where the spirit of adventure meets the power of the pack.